And you do, you know, when you study Torah, you have Yirah Shamayim, and you do mitzvahs that should be la'osim lishmo. You should do it for its own sake, in other words, without any ulterior motive. You should do it because you really want to serve the Rabbeinu Shalom. The lo'y la'osim shalom lishmo. And not to do it, you know, for those who are doing it simply, let's say, to make a career of it, or in order to simply extol their own reputation, you know, so that everybody says, oh boy, what a guy, he knows how to read Hebrew or something like that, you know. Ken the Schwarzer Pintel, as they used to say, okay? But he continues, says, V'chol ha'osa shalom lishmo, but whoever does this, in other words, whoever studies Torah and so on, with an ulterior motive, no achlo shalom nivra. So he says, it would have been better that he should not be. In other words, Torah should be studied for its own sake, because you really want to serve the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, and you want to understand how to serve him better, and not do it for any ulterior motive.
Like we are doing tonight.
Right, right, absolutely. And then, of course, we have another statement that we had before, that the Chol Ho'isim Shelo Lishmo, that whoever is doing these things, you know, with an ulterior motive, so we hope that they will do it eventually, Osim Lishmo, that they should do it, you know, for its own real sake.
For its own merit.
Right. Once you start in the study of Torah, even if you start at the beginning with other ideas, but once you become, as we would say, faltift in it, in other words, you become immersed in the study of Torah, and so eventually it should lead to the right goal, and this is what we hope for. The next statement is a very famous statement, and this is Margalo B'Fumi the Rav, another favorite statement of Rav. It says, well, Lo Koilam Hazer Hilam Habo. I mean, this we may or may not, you know, may be part of the text, because it's not necessary for the text. Literally it says, not like this world is the world to come. Essentially, the statement begins with the next word. He says, Ha'olam Habo, the world to come, Ein bo lo achilo v'lo shasir, does not have eating as part of it, it doesn't have drinking, v'lo piryo v'rivyo, nor do we have the begetting of children. This also is not part of what Olam Haba is. V'lo maso maton, nor will there be business, right, business negotiations and so on and so forth. V'lo kino, nor will there be jealousy, v'lo sino, nor hatred, below sakras, nor competition one from another, you know, elot tzaddikim yoshvim, but rather the righteous will sit, and noilam habol the atrosehim barashehim, and they will have their crowns upon their heads, v'nehenim mizif hashchina, and they will rejoice, they will have hanoah in the glory of the shechina, in the glory of the divine presence. And I wanted to say, you know, that not only is this a famous statement, but the Rambam, for example, takes this as his conception, you know, of what the Olam Haba is. So then he quotes this, you see.
That, the word Ben-Hanoim, would that be Hanoya?
Yeah, right, sure. Ne'anim is the verb, right? Hanoa is a noun. Hanoa means enjoyment. Right,
Davanoa,
enjoyment,
Davanoa,
pleasure, yeah, whatever it may be, right? Yeah. Shinhemar, what is the pasuk that tells us that? So it's, you remember, after the giving of the Ten Commandments, they made a bris between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the people of Israel, and it's written there, Vayechazu Esor Elohim, Vayechlu Vayishtu, that they beheld God, Vayechlu, and they ate, Vayishtu, and they drank. Now this obviously would seem to be a little bit contradictory. Of course, they were still in Olam Hazeh, they weren't in Olam Haba. But how do we understand, you know, what was their reaction? Because there are two opinions as to the reaction. One of them is that what they were doing was not very nice. That here they had a vision of God, and what do? They sit down on them and say, fessing and thinking, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not a very good one. So that therefore, there is another interpretation, you know, that says that in reality, what they did was, take a look at the Rashi over here. By Yochlu, by Yishtu, do you see it over there?
Oh, okay.
All right, let's take a look at the Rashi for a few moments, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right, I'll start from the new material that we started tonight. Whatever was last week, okay? He simply gave the quotation. All right, now it says, Orum Beira. Okay.
Right.
You see where it says, Dav Kuf Yud, on the side of the margin?
Okay.
Dav Kuf Yud. You see a marginal line over there? Right. All right, now go along that line. And the third word over there, you see after the two dots?
Yeah.
All right, so he quotes the words Orem B'Yur. It says that a person should be cunning as far as Yirei Shamayim is concerned. So Rashi understands that as being Laharim Bechol Minei Ermo LeYiras Boro, that a person should use every trick, every wile, and so on that he possesses in order to express his Yirei Shamayim. In other words, if somebody threatens you, learn how to be able to live in accordance with the Yirei Shamayim. Learn how to impress other people that they too should learn this quality of Yirei Shamayim and so on. All right. Then, of course, the next thing he quoted is Tachlis Chachbon, namely, what is the Tachlis of wisdom? He says Ikoro Shatora. What is the basic part? Iko means literally the root. But it also means the most important thing.
All right. You say Yiddish,
Of course. You say all the good words in Yiddish are taken from Hebrew, from Lashon Kodesh, okay? So, Ikoro Shel Torah, what is the main emphasis, what is the main element in Torah? Is Shehei Imo Teshuvah Masim Tevim. That together with Torah, you should have Teshuvah, you know, repentance, and Masim Tevim, and good deeds. And then it says, Oisa Shalei Lishmo Nerech Lo Shalem Yivro, right? The one who studies Torah not for its own sake, it's better that it would not have been created. This is what we said before. So, Perush, the explanation is, She'eno Lomeid Kedei Lekaye. He doesn't learn in order to fulfill the words of the Torah, Elo Lekanter. But rather, what he wants to do is simply to engage in arguments, to argue against anybody, you know, who observes. In other words, he wants to have that smattering of Torah that will give him the familiarity in order to argue against religion. So someone like that, it would have been better, you know, that he never got started on the study of Torah. And he quotes the source where that is to be found in the Mokum Shenarbo. Okay. Now, I'm going to skip a couple of lines because it's not over there. Well, all right, let's do it. I don't want Rashi to be angry with me. So let's take a look at the Rashi. There is a medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabba, a very beautiful statement. In Shir HaShirim it's written, you know, that when you sleep, so it's Doivev Sivsei Yushenim. Which means literally he brings about speech on the lips of those who are asleep. So the Medrash says at that particular point that whenever anybody quotes a statement by one of our great Chachomim, even though that person is in Gan Eden and, you know, his body is in the Kever, right, but nevertheless his own lips are repeating the same thing. In other words, we bring to life the words of our great authorities by quoting them. We give new life to them. So that therefore, that's why I say I don't want Rashi to have Faribal with me, because Chas v'Shalom, I should skip a Rashi. Okay, so let's continue with the Rashi over there. The reason why I wanted to skip it is because for a moment it was not quite to the point of what we were learning, but nevertheless you'd see that even there. All right. It's written, Aminon, we say over there in Mokim Shenago, the Gemara over there, it says, Rava Romek Siv al Hashemayim Chastech, or Siv Me al Hashemayim. Rava says that there is a contradiction between two psukim. One says, Ad Shemayim Chastech, which means literally your loving kindness reaches up to heaven. And then another pasuk says, Me al Hashemayim. And Me'al would mean even higher than heaven. In other words, God's loving kindness is even higher than the very heavens. So he says, Kam b'yosei shalei lishmo. So in other words, the first one refers to Ad HaShemayim. If a person studies Torah, you know, from ulterior motives, then God's mercy upon him extends only up to heaven. But Hasan, In the case of the second where it says even higher than heaven, it's just the other way Rashi understands. Okay. Rashi, I'm sorry. I understood a little differently from Rashi. Okay. So Rashi says that, okay, Ad Shamayim Chastecha, up to heaven, right? So he says, he says, Me'al HaShamayim, where it says over there, the Kambi Yosef Shalei Lishma. All right, we're talking about someone who's not studying, you know, he's studying for ulterior purposes. The Hosam Irei, and there, that other Pasuk, in other words, the first one, is the Mekayim Kadesh Chabduhu. And therefore they say the first statement only Ad Shamayim, only up to heaven, this is for one who studies. No, actually I wasn't wrong in my interpretation. The Rashi and I are both in agreement. Okay, that the person who studies from an ulterior motive, then God's mercy is only up to heaven. But if a person studies with through Yirah Shamayim, then in that case it's Me'al HaShemayim, it's even higher, you see, than heaven, God's mercies. Okay, all right, now we come to what I started to say, Vayochlu Vayishtu, right? Doesn't mean then literally that they ate and they drank, as one interpretation has it, and they didn't act very nicely. No, it says, Sovul Miziv HaShchino Kiyilu Ochlu Vishosu. In other words, says Rashi, they were so satisfied, they were so filled, which is a better translation, they were so filled with the splendor of the Shekhinah,
that it felt like,
right,
that
it's as if they had eaten
and drank.
And drunk, right.
Good explanation.
Yeah. Of course, it reminds us also, you know, of what our sages and Rashi quotes concerning about the angels who came to visit Abraham Avinu. Remember, right? Mm-hmm. It's written over there that, you know, Abraham served them and says, and they sat down, right? Tachas ha'eitz underneath the tree, vayochel and they ate. So Rashi has the following explanation. It says, ki ilu ochlu. In other words, we cannot say that an angel ate, but, you know, they made believe, they pretended as if they were eating over there. So in this particular case, it's not really that they ate and they drank, but rather they were so filled with the radiance of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, his divine presence, that as they were as happy and as satisfied as if they had eaten and drunk. Okay, let us continue now. Gedola haptocha shevtichon hakadosh baruch lenoshim yosem anoshim. Gemara now says that greater is the promise which was made by the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to the women more than to the men. Shenemar, it is written, Noshim Sha'ananos Kumno Shmano Koli. The pasuk happens to be in Yeshayahu, which says, O women, who are at ease, arise, listen to my voice. Bonos Botchos Ha'azeno Imosi. O daughters who have faith, who have trust, literally, right, who have faith, give ear unto my word. So therefore, what do we see? We see that the women are addressed by the prophet, and he's told them, you know, that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, quoting the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, he says, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam speaks to the women, and he says, listen to me and hearken unto my voice. So Rav said to Rav Chiya, Noshim b'may zachyam. So tell me, he says, what is the special zechus that the women had, you know, that the prophet says that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam speaks directly to them? Of course, which women? It's habotchos, you know, the women who have been talking, have faith in God. So he says, Vakruye banayhu lebeik nishto, vasnuye gavrayhu beirabodam. He says, the merit comes, first of all, for the fact that they bring their children to the base knesses, they bring them to shul, and at the same time they permit their husbands to go to the base medrash, Beirabonon, literally, you know, it's the same base medrash. Then notrin gavrayhu ad osim beirabonon. And not only that, but they wait for their husbands, they watch over them, they protect them, they shelter them until they come back again from the basement. So it's the special love that the women have for Torah, as expressed by the fact that they send their children to learn and they permit their husbands to go into the Beis Medrash and to learn. This is the special zechus that they have, that God, as a result of their faith, God speaks to them directly.
Which prophet?
Pardon me?
Which prophet?
Yeshayahu. Yeah, it's a pasuk from Yeshayahu.
It's a good sermon, though.
Oh, excellent, yeah. Well, after all, you know, Pesach, we say that one of the major reasons for the redemption of our people is Biskus Noshim Tzidkonios. It was in the merit of the righteous women that Nigalu Abbasin Mitzrayim. And, you know, our sages give various interpretations. One of them is the fact, you know, that when the husbands were working hard in the fields and, you know, they were suffering all backbreaking labor and so on, the women, if you remember, would come out to them, bring them their lunch, and they would make themselves beautiful to their husbands, and then, you know, they would have relations with them, and as a result, this is what enabled the people of Israel to increase in spite of all the persecution that we had. And therefore, this is the reason, say, our sages, that, and this goes back to, you know, the Sedra Pekudei, that where it's written over there, that they made the basin in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, b'maros hatzovos. They made it from the mirrors of the women who would come to the tabernacle in order to, because they looked at the mirror, they enticed their husbands, they gave them courage to continue in spite of the backbreaking slavery in which they endured. And so therefore, this was the special merit that they had, for which reason Rabbeinu Shalom took us out of the slavery of freedom, slavery of Egypt, and brought us into freedom. Okay, let us continue a little bit more. Ki halim mipatri rabbanim bei rabbami, when the rabbis would leave Rabbani's Beis Medrash, the Amelah and bei Rab Chanina, another say it was Rabbi Chanina's Beis Medrash, so Amelah hochi. They would say to him as follows: Olamcha sireh b'chayecha. May you see Olam Haba in your own lifetime. In other words, the joy, you know, the nachas, the reward of the Rabbeinu Shalom, may you see even in your lifetime. V'yachrisko l'chayeh Olam Haba. And may your reward, the future, be the life of the world to come. May your hope endure from generation to generation. May your heart utter understanding. May your mouth speak wisdom. And may your tongue be filled with melodies. And may your eyelids look straight wherever you are going. In other words, you know, may you always have clear vision. Einecho yo'iru b'maor Torah, may your eyes light up in the light of Torah. Uponecho yashiru k'zohar rakia, and may your face shine as the brightness of the firmament. Sifsosecha yabiu das, may your lips express or flow with wisdom, with understanding. V'tiryosecho, and may your, literally, your kidneys, but what it means over here, you see, they, the kloyos, and then in Tilim, in Mishle, the kidneys are considered one of the seats of wisdom, right? So therefore, the kiryasecha ta'alozdan eisharim, and may your kidneys, or sometimes they're translated reins, R-E-I-N-S, okay, rejoice with righteousness, ufo'amecha, and may your footsteps, your roots of run, lishma divrei atik yomin, to hear the words of the Ancient of Days, meaning to Beis Shemayim. In other words, may every part of your body be blessed, that you will be able to teach Torah, to teach wisdom, to teach the right way, and may you have Olam Haba even in your lifetime. Ki havim mipatri rabbanim beirav chisto, and likewise the rabbanim would leave the base medrash of Rav Chisto. V'yamuloi ben beirav Shmuel bar Nachmeni, don't say it was the base medrash of Shmuel bar Nachmeni. Omuloi hocha, they would say to him as follows. And here they are quoting a verse in Tehillim. In Tehillim it's written, Alufeinim esubolim, okay? They would say to him, Alufeinim esubolim, ein peretz, ein yotzes, ein svocha b'chavosein. That's the way the pasuk runs in Tehillim. Now, in the English translation, if you'll take a look, you'll see that Alufeinim esubolim, they translate, you know, may our oxen be loaded, in other words, may they be able to carry the greatest burdens, all the famous subolim, ein peretz, yein yotzeis, may there be no breaches, no breaks, in other words, may there always be peace without any destruction, the ein svocha b'chavoseinu, and let there never be any outcry in our streets, in other words, the outcry of war, in other words, may we always be safe from harm and from war. Okay? This is what the pasuk means. However, Alufeinim esubolim, when it came to these words, Alufeinim esubolim, Rabu Shmuel, so Rab and Shmuel gave the following interpretation, the Yamalei Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Eleza, and others say that the disagreement as to how to interpret these two words was between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Eleza. Chadoma Alufeinu batorah umesubolim b'mitzvos. The Chadoma Alufeinu batorah umesubolim umesubolim b'yisur. Okay. Which means as follows. Okay, first of all, let's take the word Alufeinu again. Okay? Aluf, as I said, could not only be translated as an ox, the way the English translation in Tehillim puts it, but the word Aleph in the Talmud very often means to instruct. So that therefore Alufeinu would mean those among us who are instructed in Torah, in other words, our Talmidim, right? Misuboli. So one interpretation is Alufeinu Batorah, those of us, those among our students who are learned in Torah, Misubolim b'mitzvos, that they may also be literally burdened, but in other words, loaded with mitzvos, okay? The Chadamar, the other interpretation is Alufeinu Batorah mitzvos, may our students be filled with Torah and mitzvos, Misubolim b'yisur, and may they also be loaded with Yisurim. Now, why they should be deserve Yisurim, this already is a problem. But I think what we have to say is as follows, okay? First of all, we did learn much, much early in the first parak that there are such things as Yisurim Shalahava, in other words, these are Yisurim for which we have no explanation, but the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants to test us in this world so that we may be worthy of the world to come. So perhaps this is the reference that he has over here. That, when he says, Misubolim, that we should be burdened with Yisurim, he means in a sense, that we should be able to withstand any trials, any tests that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam sends to us. Ein peretz, the rest of the pasuk, if you remember, was there is no break in peretz. Shelotahe siyosinu kusiyato shel David. May our group not be like the group of David HaMelech. What's wrong with David HaMelech's group? The answer is sheyotzim menu achitofel. The answer is that achitofel or Ahithophel in English came from the group of David. In other words, David's group unfortunately had someone who broke, who breached, and went out to an evil end, right? To evil counsel, and that was Achitophel. Achitophel was the man who first counseled David in several things that were good. But then what did he do? He organized a conspiracy together with David's son Absalom in order to try to kill King David and have Absalom succeed him on the throne. So we see, may we have in our group no one who will ever be like that, who will ever breach. In other words, we shouldn't have bad Talmidim among us. The Ein Yotzeis, Shelotei Siyosena Kisiyatosho Shol. And what does it mean that there shouldn't be anyone going out? Again, it's the same thing, that our group should not be like that of King Saul. From whose midst? That is, from the midst of the group that surrounded King Saul, and originally, you know, were his counselors in Torah, you had Doeg the Edomite, the Paskunyak, who, if you remember, at Saul's instigation, he was the one who killed the Kohanim in Nob, and he almost killed David. I mean, why did he do it? He did it because they welcomed King David. They welcomed David. David wasn't king yet at that time. But they welcomed David, and they gave him you know, bread to eat, and they gave him a sword and so on. And when King Saul found out about it, so he sent an army to punish them. The army refused. They refused to lift their hands against
David.
Not just against David. David had escaped, but they refused to lift their hands against the priest, against the Kohanim and Nob. So this Doeg Adomi came and he did it. He did the job.
He killed him.
Right. So may we not have somebody like this Doeg Adomi. The Yain Tzibocha, nor should we have any outcry. We shouldn't have, again, someone like in the group, the disciples of Elisha. If you read the story about Elisha the prophet, you'll know that Gehazi was his shamus, so to speak. Okay, he was his disciple, and Elisha sent him on many errands. But in the famous case about Naaman, who came to Elisha in order to be cured of his leprosy, so Gehazi, if you remember, Naaman refused to accept any gift from Naaman wanted to give, you know, all kinds of gold, silver, and everything else and so on to Elisha because he had been cured. Elisha refused to accept anything from him. Told him, you know, to go in peace. So after Naaman had started on his way back to Damascus, where he lived, he was the general, you know, commander-in-chief of the king of Syria, the king of Aram's army. So Gehazi ran after him and told him that Elisha had changed his mind and he was willing to accept the gift. So, you know, Naaman didn't know any better and he gave it to him. But the point is that when Elisha found out about it, he said to Gehazi, I hope that the leprosy which had afflicted Naaman and had departed from him will now be yours as a punishment for daring to besmirch the reputation of a man of God by doing it for the sake of money, for the gold and the silver and everything else. So may we not have disciples, in other words, then of the character of Gehazi. Bechov Oseinu, yes, in our streets, Shelo Yehei Lanu Bein O Talmid Shemakdiach Tavshil Barabi. And in general, what does it mean in our streets? It means that in our streets may we never have a Talmud Chacham or a son, either one. We shouldn't have children, nor should we have Talmidim who literally spoil their food in public. Well, Makdich Tavshil Barabba means, in other words, that they go out to, you know, as we would say, Tarbes Bor, in other words, they do that which is evil. They desert Yiddishkeit, they do everything, you know, called over us, as we'd say, everything which is prohibited, and they bring shame upon us as parents, or shame upon us as teachers of these people. So may we never have that. Okay, I think that we will stop at this particular point. And yes, Hashem, next week, as you see, we are ready to complete at last the second parak and to begin the third parak in Brachos. Yeah. So, have a good evening.
Good evening.
And if you didn't have a chance to count Sphere yet, remember last night was number 8. Yud Zion Omid Beis. Yud Zion. Okay. First of all, for those of you to whom this is new, okay, Yud Zion Omid Beis is just before Yud Ches. You see Yud Ches over here? Yeah. Now this is Yud Zion Omid Beis. Yud Zion. Okay. Pages in the Gemara. Numbered Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, etc., etc., right?
Right.
So that Yud Zayin is 17, and one side, the first side is called Amud Aleph, and the other side is called Amud Beis. we are now on Yud Zayin Omid Beis. This is where we left off last week. And we're about to be finishing this evening the second chapter in Brachos. Right.
Second parak?
Yeah, we'll be finishing the second parak, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
One more.
There are nine.
Second
page. Yeah.
Mirza Hashem.
One of these days we'll finish.
God willing. God willing.
The way that they get to finish it is by going.
That's right.
Week after week and continuously.
Right?
Yeah. All right. All right. We start now on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the seventh line from the top. Two words from the end over there. You see where it says Shimuei line?
Right.
Okay. The previous statement that we had dealt with a difference of opinion between several of the authorities. We don't know exactly which authority is the one who said it, and not only that, but it's a question as to which pair of authorities have the disagreement. One of them is that they say that the disagreement in the interpretation of the verse was by Rav and Shmuel. And others say that it was Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar. So, just as we had in the previous case, a disagreement among these authorities as to how do you teach the Pasuk happened to be at that time, if you remember, at the bottom of page Yud Zayin Amid Aleph, where they take a Pasuk and Telem, Alapen Misubolim, Aim Peretzi and Yetzes, Vein Sevoch B'Yachav Osenu, and they interpret it to the effect that those of us, which as I explained to you last week, literally it's translated as our oxen are loaded. But since the word aluf is from a word which also means to instruct, to teach, in other words, the verb alef means to teach also, so alufeinu misubolim, they take in the sense that our students, those of us who study Torah, are loaded with what? If they study Torah, they also become loaded with mitzvahs. And another authority said, not only Torah and mitzvahs, but also, unfortunately, yisurim. In other words, they also have problems, physical problems and other problems that they have to say. And then they continue the pasuk, ein peretz v'ein yotzeis, that there is no peretz, there is no breach v'ein yotzeis, nor is there someone who leaves the fold. And they say, we hope that every one of our students, in other words, remains within the fold, dedicated to the teaching of Judaism, dedicated to the observance of the mitzvahs, and that we don't have people who unfortunately would be like in the group of the first one that they mentioned, Siato Shel David, the group of David, and the other one is the Siato Shel Shaul, those of King Shaul, where in each case there was one person who went out, as we would say, the Shabbos Roy, he went out and he did evil. In the case of David HaMelech, it happened to be Achitophel, the man who first was his advisor, the man who gave him counsel in Torah, and as we say in Pirkei Avos, in the last chapter that we have, where we say that in other words, if you learn from your teacher a chapter or even a pasuk or even one letter, in other words, you understand the difference that a letter in the Torah makes as far as how it applies to the observance of Torah and mitzvahs and so on. If you learn even one teaching at all, it says there you should call him alufo, rabo alufo yudoi, call him Rabbi, call him my master, my teacher, Alufi, the one who has instructed me, Mudoi, and the one who is beloved by me. Okay? And they gave the example in that David learned a couple of lessons from Achitophel, and he called him Alufi, Rabbi Alufi Mudoi. So, here was a man from whom David HaMelech learned some very important teachings for his life. Yes.
Can I close in? I'm getting a gap.
Yeah, sure, please. Be my guest.
Wow, would you kindly sit here rather than close that? Because it is very warm in here. Perhaps we'll sit down in this end. Thank you so much. Well, come here. It's really warm down here. Really warm. I didn't try to close it.
All right, so Achitophel left
King David. And instead, what did he indulge in? He went, and he went together with David's son, Absalom, and conspired with Absalom in order to
overthrow
King David, to seize the throne, and actually they were out to murder King David too in the process, you see. So he is the peretz, he is the one who broke, you see. And whereas we pray, Ein peretz, that there will not be anyone who will break our ranks the way he did. And as far as the person who left the company of King Saul, it happened to be Doeg, Domi, who at first was considered a wise counselor dedicated to the study of Torah, and yet what did Doeg do? The time, as I explained to you last week, when King Saul was pursuing after David, he wanted to find David and kill him, and he discovered that David had found refuge in the city of Nob, which was a city of Kohanim, so he sent troops in order to kill the Kohanim in the city of Nob as a punishment for having sheltered King David. The troops refused, but Doeg HaEdomi, he is the one who took a sword and he killed these different people. So may we not have such people like him. And also let us not have people like in the case of the prophet Elisha, who had Gehazi. Yes.
Doeg HaEdomi? He was in the Jewish army?
Yeah. King David had people who had come from, you know, their birth. Right, their birth may have been among a foreign nation.
He was an Edomite.
But nevertheless, right, he was an Edomite by birth, but, you know, he became Jewish and he served King David, right.
He was a Ger.
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure.
I mean, there are those, for example, who say that the expression crazy and placy means that King David also had, let's say, soldiers who were by birth from either Crete or from the Philistines or something like that, but they came and they served David, and of course obviously they became Jewish when they did so. And we learned that one of King David's generals was in charge of this division of the crazy and the placy. Of course the Gemara gives a different interpretation as to what crazy and placy is. They say crazy and placy, these were people who decided the law in the Sanhedrin so that, you know, they don't want to identify them as being goyim by birth, but instead they apply it to a different thing. They say that these are the members of the Sanhedrin who are korsim, in other words, they make decisions on behalf of the Jewish people, and placy, they give judgment for the people of Israel, you see. So that this is how they interpret it afterwards. Okay. And then the third example that, you know, our students should not be like is in the case of the prophet Elisha, as we learned, who had a disciple Gehazi, and I related to you how, right, last week I told you how Naaman, the Syrian general, came to Elisha in order to be cured of leprosy, and I won't go into the entire story, we'll read it one of these Shabbosim as a Haftorah, and we then, actually this year is going to be skipped because we're going to read Tazri and Mitzorah together this year, so we skip it. When they're separated, then we read one of the story on Tazri, and then for Mitzorah we read the other one, which also comes from the same period in the book of Kings, only it speaks about four lepers who were forced to be outside the camp, and how they discovered the good news that when the army of Syria had besieged the people of Israel, the Syrian army were suddenly frightened during the night, they fled, and the famine, which was so severe in Shomron, Samaria, the capital city of Israel, was finally broken because of that. So this is our custom that when you have Tazri and Mitzorah together, naturally you always read in the Haftorah form, Mitzorah, the second one.
What had them run off?
Huh?
What had the Assyrians run off?
They heard the Rebbeinu Shalalem made noises during the night, and they got frightened. They thought, you see, that the king of the Hittites was coming to do battle with them. And, you know, the Hittites represented an even worse threat to them, because the Hittites would attack immediately the city of Damascus, their capital, you see. And so in order to save their own capital from destruction, therefore they lifted the siege of Shomron. So that this is it.
But Shomron was the capital of
Shomron was Israel. The capital of Northern Israel.
Northern
right,
Israel.
The kingdom of Israel. Yeah.
When that's during the separation.
Yeah, after the people, right, after the, you know, the tribes of Israel became separated into two different kingdoms, one of Judah. That was the one which still kept Jerusalem as its capital and had a descendant of King David as its ruler. And the other one, Shomron, which was built actually after the first few kings, but was built by Omri, and it became the capital until the time that it was finally destroyed by the Assyrians when they conquered it roughly about the year 722 or something like that.
Did they build another base of Mikdash in Shomron?
They didn't build it in Shomron. What happened is that Yeroboam ben Nevat, the man who split the people of Israel and established his own kingdom, he built two temples. One in Bethel. I don't know whether it's related to the Bethel here. And the other one in Dan, in the northern part of Israel. So that his idea was that that way did two things. First of all, he again set up golden calves, believe it or not, in these places. Mm. So that, you know, that was one thing, you know. He went in the footsteps of the generation of the wilderness, unfortunately. The other thing is, his major purpose was to prevent Jews from going to Jerusalem on pilgrimages. People wanted to go, so he stationed armies on the borders in order to prevent them from doing it. You know, like Lahavdil, many others, like the Gorbachev in Lithuania is doing
today. The sacrifice of the golden calf, too.
Yeah. So Mishigas, right. But, you know, there are those who, at least the original idea, the golden calf, and, you know, they explained that in reality it was not a calf that they were worshipping, but they thought that somehow or other this represented the power of God or something like that, that they were celebrating, you know, when they said that this is your God, O Israel, who took you out of the land of Egypt. But I don't have to tell you, I mean, that it was a sin, and, you know, he perpetrated these sins. And this is why, for example, in Pirkei Avos, they give Yeroboam ben Nevat, you know, this man who did this, who was the first king of the northern kingdom of Israel, they call him a chote, a sinner, umachti, and who caused others to sin as well. And, you know, they say that such a sinner doesn't have ilum haba, be punished instead.
Dr. Miller.
Yes.
I was in Israel, all right?
Yeah.
They showed us, they talked about Israel, they talked about the whole history from beginning to end.
Boy,
okay?
That's a long stretch, eh?
A long stretch, right. Yeah. They didn't mention about Pine Sinai. They didn't mention about Moses going up at Pine Sinai.
Yeah.
They didn't show you the different things that they were showing you in the picture.
Yeah.
In the Passover picture,
yeah.
They didn't show you
yeah.
the original where everything goes.
So what are you going to do?
No, I'm just asking a question then.
Yeah.
Now, you're a very learned man, you know me, you know everything. You know about history.
What's the question?
Hey, babe,
what's the question?
What's the question? We have to learn over here,
where
right?
Is,
yeah.
Where is the place where Moses went up from the Pine Sinai?
Well,
do you know where
yeah.
exactly it is?
We know approximately, but exactly we don't know. Okay.
You know.
No, approximately, but not exactly.
You don't
okay.
Know.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, as I told you, you know, Naaman came in order to be cured. Elisha cured him. Naaman wanted to give him a great gift in appreciation. Elisha refused, and then Gehazi, the wise guy, ran after Naaman to say that Elisha changed his mind and he'll accept the gift because he wanted it for himself, you see. And when Elisha found out about it, you know, I don't have to tell you, it besmirched the name of Elisha in the eyes of Naaman and anybody else, and therefore he said that may the leprosy of Naaman cling to you, this should be your punishment. But we shouldn't have, in other words, disciples as close as they are who go out to Tabrisro, who go out and do evil things. All right, now let's continue. So they have a disagreement about another pasuk, and this is a pasuk taken in the prophet Yeshayahu. It says, Shimu Eli Abire Lev Horchoke Mitzdoka, which means literally, listen unto me, Abire Lev, those of you who are strong of heart or stout of heart, as they say in the Jung's translation, or a cholkim and tzedakah, who are far from salvation. And they tried to understand what is the meaning of this. Again, there's a disagreement between Rav and Shmuel, the army law, and those who say that the disagreement was between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar. All right, what is the disagreement? Chad Omar, one of them interprets it as follows. Kol ha'olam kulo nizonim b'tzedakah. The entire world is being provided for. In other words, Rabbeinu Shalom gives food to the entire world. B'tzedakah. What does it mean, b'tzedakah? That the Rabbeinu Shalom is doing it out of his own goodness of his heart, so to speak, you know, like when you give tzedakah to someone. In other words, they don't deserve it, right? But nevertheless, Rabbeinu Shalom is giving them their food. The haim is zonim mizroa. But the haim, they, meaning the abirei lev, right, they are being fed bizra, which would mean literally by their arm, but what it means over here is by the righteousness of their own personality. In other words, others receive their food because of God's grace unto them, even though they don't deserve it. But these people rightly deserve the mozon, they rightly deserve the panasa, which Rabbeinu Shalom sends to them. So this is one interpretation. The Chadomar, but another one, the other one says that, no, you have to take the Pasuk and interpret it differently. It says, Koloem Kulay Nizoinim Bizchusam. The entire world is being supported, is being fed because of the Zechus, because of the merit of whom? Of the Abirei Lev, in other words, the Tzaddikim. They're the reason why the world continues to exist and to receive, Mizonis, the reason. But they, even in their own merit, do not have enough parnasa for themselves. Even though they are righteous, but they do not have parnasa in their own schools, in their own merit. Shidda Rav Yehuda Omar Rav, as Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, the Omar Rav Yehuda Omar Rav, as Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, Bechol Yom Vayom, Baskol Yotzeis V'Hachorev, every single day, a Baskol, which means a heavenly voice, goes from Har Chorev, Mount Chorev, which is another name for Mount Sinai, the Omeris. And what does this heavenly voice say? It says, Kol Hoylam Kuloi Nizoinim Bishvil Chanino Beni. The entire world has its Parnasa because of my son Chanino. By Chanino, of course, one of the great Tzaddikim mentioned in Gemara and Tainus, Rabbi Chanino Bedos, about whom they tell many, many beautiful things about his great righteousness. The Chanino Bani, and Chanino Bani, you know, the world, in other words, for whose merit, for whose sake, the entire world has Parnasa, is Dailo Bekav Karuvim Yehav Shabbos Yehav Shabbos. For him it's enough to exist with a, like a peck, or a bushel, of Karuvim. You know what Karuvim are? That's boxer. Karuvim is boxer. The English word Karab, of course, is related to the word Karuv over here, okay? Mm-hmm. So he has like a bushel of boxer that he eats, and this is his food from one Erev Shabbos to the next Erev Shabbos. He has nothing else to eat the entire week except that. And yet, here is a man who asks very little for himself, is satisfied with so little, but in his merit the entire world
is fed.
Right. Ufaligo the Rabbi Yehuda, Dama Rav Yehuda. And this is in disagreement with Rav Yehuda, who said, Man Abirei Lev. In other words, he gives a different touch to who are the Abirei Lev. He takes it not in the sense of the strong-hearted or the tzaddikim, as we have said until now, but he gives it a different application. He says, these are Govai Tipshai. Says, these are the stupid people who live in Gova. What is Gova? Well, we learned, if you remember, in the last chapter of Kiddushin, where they have a geographic description of Babylonia and the different characteristics of people who live in this place and live in another place and so on. So, one of the places mentioned happens to be Gova, and these are the Govai, the people who live over there. Now, what about them? So, the answer is, by the way, Rashi, you know, reminds us that according to the sages, the people who lived in Govai were not 100% Jewish. They were Nesinim, if you remember, like second-class Jews, you see, the descendants of the Gibeonites.
Mm.
Okay, so at any rate, what about them? Why does he call them Gavai Tipshai? You know, a Tipesh, you know what a Tipesh is? A fool, an Ar, okay.
Yeah, Tipesh, yeah.
Right.
Yiddish
foolish Gavai, he says. Omar Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef says, Teda the holo Gayer Giyura Minayil. Says, you should know that in the city of Gavai, not a single person has ever converted to Yiddishkeit in that place. Which was mean what? Which would mean that here they are, they're living among Jews, they see the beauty of Jewish life, and yet not one of them has ever been tempted in that area to want to be Jewish. Right. So that therefore they are Abirei Lev, in other words, they are stout hearted in the sense that nothing enters, nothing penetrates the hardness of the heart. Omer Rav Ashi, so Rav Ashi gives a similar example. He says, B'nei Mosa Mechatsia Abirei Lev Nino. Says the people of Moshe Machasi are also Abirei Lev. In other words, stout-hearted in the sense that they don't learn by the example. Twice a year they behold the beauty, the glory of the Torah, meaning, alright, let me explain. Moshe Machasi was a Jewish suburb by and large, okay? And in it was one of the great yeshivas. And in Babylonia, the custom arose of what we call the Yarchei Kala. In other words, twice during the year, people would come from all over in order to learn Torah, to listen to lectures and to learn Torah and so on. The Yarchei is, of course, the word Yerach, which means, in this case, month. Kalo means over here, like the group of people who come together in order to learn Torah, okay? Mm-hmm. During the month of Adar and during the month of Elul, people would come together for Yarchei Kalo. And here, thousands and thousands of people came to Moshe Machasya, and the Goyim in Moshe Machasya could see how beautiful and how much honor was given to the Torah in this place twice a year, below Komagaya Giyur Minayim. And yet again, not a single ger, not a single convert to Yiddishkeit ever came from among these goyim in Moshe Machasya. I just want to add that, you know, today there have been again attempts to revive this custom of Yarchei Kala. You'll take a look, for example, in Eretz Israel, several of the yeshivas now have Yarchei Kala. Remember that, of course, originally the idea, why did they choose Adar and why did they choose Elul?
Elul,
you can write, it's before the high holidays, and naturally they could very often, you know, discuss the coming high holidays, their importance, how you would serve them, and so on and so forth, the various dinim, halachas, midrashim, and so on, you know.
Also because of an agrarian society, and they could just let that field...
Well, this is true. This is true, yes. In other words, by the time that Elul came, then presumably a great deal of the agricultural work had been done, but yeah, there was a little bit too soon, perhaps, for the harvest, so that this is like an off-season for them. Yeah, well, that's, you know, an economic explanation. But more important is really the Torah explanation, as I say, to dedicate this time to preparation for the Yom Tovim by learning, and the same thing with the month of Adar, because in Adar, while it's true that you have Purim, but of course, what does it immediately precede? Pesach. And Pesach has all kinds of dinim and halachas and so on. You know how we prepare for Pesach. I mean, it's not only to know what we have to do, but you know that the house is turned topsy turvy, and then Abed Toganacht, you know, in order to make the house Pesachic, etc., etc. So this is, you know, spiritual preparation for the holidays. So that today, in Eretz Yisrael, for example, several of the yeshivas now run Yarchei Kala. I know Yossi did it a few years ago, it's called the time. He arranged for it, right?
Almost.
In the month of Elul, right. They arrange all kinds of programs of learning, people come. And it's like a hotel, right. And they come in and they hear Shiurim, and then they have activities for them, like sightseeing, swimming, tours, and, you know, different things for them.
Not everyone is on the same level at all.
No, so you have Shiurim according to everybody's level. If you have enough people, you know, so you make a shiur on this level, shiur on another level, and so on, people could choose the level that they want.
it almost coincides to in some way to the old custom of the rabbis used to have a crush twice a year.
Yeah, right.
Pesach and,
right. I mean, Shabbos HaGadol, the original idea of having a Midrash of Shabbos HaGadol was also to prepare the people for the laws of Pesach. After that, it became already a contest to see, you know, how much chidushim you could make up and things like to show your brilliance and so on, you know. With Shabbos Shuvah, of course, as its name tells you, I mean, the idea is to prepare people to Shuvah, right, and, you know, to prepare them spiritually for Yom Kippur, which was coming. So, you know, that's why the custom developed. It's correct. All right. Now, the last part of the Mishnah that we had, and I call your attention again to it, which was on page Tes Zion, Omid Aleph.
Tes Zion, right, okay.
Yeah, well, let's see, we did a little bit more. Ah, excuse me, turn the page. The Tes Zion, Omid Beis.
Okay.
We were speaking over there, if you remember, about a chosim. If he wants to recite Krishna the first night, in other words, the marriage night, so there's a difference of opinion. The Chachomim, who will go, you know, they're not mentioned who they are, but it says, Chosin Imrotza, this is the last part of the Mishnah over there. It says, Chosin Imrotza Likros Kriya Shema Laila Rishon Korek,
right?
If a Chosin wants to read Krishna the first night, then he reads it, he recites the Krishna. Rabbi Shimon ben Ali, Rabbi Shimon ben Ali says, Lo kolorotza litol es Hashem yitol. Not everyone who wants to take this title or to assume the title that he's a great Talmud Chacham and he's a great Yerei Shemayim can do so. Of course, this was in reference to the story that we read about Rabbi Gamliel on the previous page, where it was written. Yeah. I'm quoting for a moment on 32. Okay?
Yeah.
And then we'll get back again to 34. Okay?
Yeah,
okay. Alright. If you remember, we read about Rabban Gamliel. You know, that first they quoted the fact that a chosin is potter from Krishna, right? Does not have to recite Krishna on marriage night. Okay? And his wedding night. As a matter of fact, they give him several other days in case he has not been able to consummate the marriage the first night. So he's excused the second night or the third night. Some total Ad Motzei Shabbos, because presumably the wedding would take place on Wednesday night, right? So they would give him Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, and Ad Motzei Shabbos. In other words, they give him three nights. By then, they think, right? Yeah.
What happens if the woman is legal when she gets married?
Oh no! So in that case, obviously he cannot sleep with her.
Not only that, it's not going to be still.
Correct. So in that case, he says
what? In case of what?
Right.
You can't consummate the marriage.
No, of course not.
And she's a what?
She's a nidah.
Oh, nidah, yeah,
right,
of course.
Right, so he cannot consummate them. That's correct.
He's not supposed to sleep with her under those
conditions. Right. But if you remember, the original discussion ran that first they quote this, okay? Chachamim say this and this and this. Then, how about Rabban Gamliel? So we say, Rabban Gamliel said, I do not want to be absolved from feeling the yoke of the kingdom of heaven upon me even for a moment. Therefore, he read Krishna. Okay? Now, this is in reference, harking back again to that, where the Chachamim say, what? That if a chassan wants to read Krishna, Laila Rishon Sokari, he reads. But Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Omer, he says that not everybody who wants to take the title of what? In other words, who wants to compare himself with Rabbi Gamliel is permitted to do so. This is what he's saying, okay? Rabban Gamliel says, not even for a moment do I want to be free of the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, from feeling the power of God over me. But can every Tom, Dick, and Harry feel exactly the same way that Rabban Gamliel? Can he make the same claim? So, this is what Rabban Shimon Gamliel is saying. All right, so now they discuss that, and they say, Lameima, are we to say then that the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel chayish liyuharot? Rabbanan lo chayish liyuharot? Are we to say that Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was concerned with pride? In other words, a person shouldn't, or egoism, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, over here. Yep.
Now I'm going back over here.
All right. Yeah. Now that we've seen, you know, gone back again.
Halfway
we're
down,
on Tes Zion Omid Beis. Excuse me, Yud Zion Omid Beis. Yud Zion Omid Beis. And we're at the last group of statements now before the end of the second parak. Okay? All right?
The asterisk.
Starting with the asterisk over there. So are we to say that Rabbi Shimon Liel was concerned, right, with the fact that no person should feel that he's such an egoist, you know, that he can make the same claim that Rabbi Gamliel did? Whereas the Rabbonin, they don't worry about that. Therefore, if a person wants to say Krishna, he can say Krishna, they said. On the contrary, we learn that in another passage, the opinions were just the opposite. Ditnan, Mokim Shinoga Lasis Beloka Batishabov, Oisin. Mokim Shinoga Shaloy Lasis, Ain Oisin. The Chol Mokim Tapire Chachovim Betalim. Alright, the Mishnah says that, this is a reference now to Tishabov, it says that where you are in a community where they do work on Tisha B'Av, then Oisin, you're permitted to go to work and to do work. Okay? Mokim Shaloi Nagu, right? Mokim Shanogo Shaloi Lasos, but in a place, in a community where the minhug is not to do any work on Tisha B'Av, Ein Oisin, then you do not. Okay?
Right.
Alright, so that's the first statement. Let me, of course, before I continue, explain what is this business about doing melacha on Tisha B'Av. Why not do melacha on Tisha B'Av?
No blessing. No
well, okay, you're correct. I mean, that they say that if a person, you know, does not feel avelis on Yerushalayim, he won't see a simon bracha from his work. You're absolutely right about that, okay?
Simon bracha from the work he does, right.
Yeah. In other words, he will not get eventually any benefits out of it, okay? But why did they make that statement? Because the answer is that they want people to concentrate on Tisha B'Av upon the Avelis. Is an Ovel permitted to go and do work?
No.
No, it's not permitted, right? The person sitting Shiva is not allowed to go and do work. He's supposed to concentrate upon his grief, his sorrow, and so on. And, you know, this is so Tisha B'Av too. We are all Avelim. And therefore, we also should concentrate on our sorrow if we possibly can. Of course, there are times when you have to go to work. But if you're in a community where the community has this minhag not to do any work, then in that particular case, you don't do work on Tisha B'Av. Then they continue and they say, the Chol Mokim, and everywhere, even in those places, in other words, where work is permitted on Tisha B'Av, Talmidei Chachomim B'Talim, those who are, you know, scholars of the Torah, they do not do any work on Tisha B'Av, even in the community where it's done. Now, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Emer, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Li'olam Yaseh Kol Adam Esatzmei K'Talmid Chacham, says, in truth, every person should always try to consider himself as a Talmid Chacham in this respect. In other words, if it is possible at all for you
not to
do any work, don't do any work. Alright? So, in that particular case, we see that it's Kashi the Rabbonin ad Rabbonon and Kashi the Rabbonin Shimon ben Gamliel ad Rabbonin Shimon ben Gamliel. There is then a contradiction in the thought system, if you wish, between the Chachomim and the Chachomim. Here, in the case of the Mishnah about reciting Krishma on the night of marriage, what did the Chachomim say?
And if you want to say, you can say it.
Right. They say, if you feel like doing it, right. So in other words, they are not concerned with what we would call putting on the air that Gaiva, you consider Gaiva, yourself like Gaiva. A Talmud Chacham or something like that, right?
Gaiva,
correct, okay? Whereas, when it comes to Tisha B'Av, we say, everyone, if he wants to, can consider himself what?
Like a Talmud Chacham,
okay. And in the case of, you know, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, so again, you know, here he seems to be concerned with Yuhara, and then he says he's not concerned with Yuhara, because he says anybody who wants to, you know, can consider himself a Talmud Chacham. Case number one, don't consider yourself, and case number two, consider yourself. So it seems to be a contradiction. So therefore, Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan says, book lepas hashita. In that case, change around the names.
Change around the names.
Let Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel be consistent in both counts, and let the Chachamim be consistent on both accounts with their own theory. In other words, that in the case of Shimon ben Gamliel, let's say that he is Kayish Liyuharo. In other words, he is concerned that people should not put on airs, right? And in the case of Chachamim, let's say that they're not concerned at all about that, okay? Well, this doesn't always satisfy when you say Muklefes Hashita. In other words, turn it around so that, you know, the names become consistent one to the other. Rav Shesha B'Reid Rav Ili Omar Liyolem Leistakli. He says, no, don't change it around. The Rabbonin are the Rabbonin Leikasha. First of all, there is no contradiction between one statement of the Rabbonin and the other one. Why? Because he says, Kriya Shma Kevan Dukuli Yalma Kokoru. Says in the case of Krishna, since everybody recites Krishna, right? So if the Chassan recites Krishna, it's not going to seem that he's doing it as an act of gaita, okay? Hocha, and how about in the case of Tisha B'av? Says Kevan the Chulei Almo Avde Malocha the Yulek Yovid, Nefsa Yuhara, right? You might think at first blush that if everybody does work in the community on Tisha B'Av and he doesn't do any work, so it would seem as if he was doing it because, again, he wants to be considered a show-off, right, that he's a Talmud Chacham. So that's how you might say, right? The Rabban Shimon Gamliel ad Rabban Shimon Gamliel Leikashi says there's no contradiction either in one statement upon the other. In the case of Krishna, what does Krishna ultimately depend on? You have to have the kavana. You must have the basic intention that you want to serve God when you recite Krishna. Nope. So inasmuch as you must have kavana, and we know that his kavana is a little bit turned to something else that night, he's worried about how is he going to
consummate
the marriage, what will his bride be like, how will he perform, and so on and so forth, you know, since he's concerned about all these things, so he doesn't have the proper concentration. This is what we would say, okay? Whereas Avol Hochon, the case of Tisha B'Av, Horoya, if somebody sees a man who's not doing any work, so he says, says, oh, I guess the guy must be unemployed today, doesn't have any work today to perform. Go out into the marketplace and you'll see how many people there are milling about over there without any work to do that day. So that therefore, if the Talmud Chacham decides not to do any work, or if any person wants to do any work, then people are not going to start in to say, he's putting on airs. Because as far as they're concerned, all that they know about him is the fact that he's not doing work. He didn't have any work to do that day.
So in that way, Rabbi Gamliel says he's consistent, right.
Okay. Hadran Allah Fayakori, with this we finish the second parak. Now, a little introduction. Do you remember that in the second parak, we dealt with primarily, you know, basic concepts such as that you should have kavana when you say Krishna. How far should the kavana extend? And as we saw, naturally the ideal would be through the entire Krishna. Less ideal would be at least with the first paragraph of the Shema. Less than that would be up to Olive Ovecha. Right. And finally, at least have Krishna, have kavana when you cite Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And because of that, so we learned that, you know, hand in hand with kavana goes some other things. As for example, a person should be medakdek, you know, you should be careful in how you enunciate the Kriya Shema. Don't slur the words, don't run one into another, and
make
so
sure
on. You know, try to be careful,
and so
right.
On.
And we saw it even extends to, for example, Vavadatem, Meherod, make a pause between them so that the two men still run together, and Aldevodecho, that the two lamas still run together, so it becomes like one word, and so on. We should be careful with these things. But we also saw that sometimes not everybody has the ideal of kavana, and so therefore, what did we learn? We learned that there is a distinction between what they call the chatchilah and b'di'evet. Remember those two concepts? L'chatchila means to begin with, to start with, you should try to do everything to the very best of your ability. But if not, then l'chatchila v'yoytza, we say, v'yoytza with what you did. Now this applied to some other areas that we learned in the Gemara. As for example, to begin with, when you say Krishna, your ears should hear what you are reciting, right? But we learned that if you didn't do it, so the Chachamim say that you yaitze with it. Okay? Right, you yaitze. And this is how the din.
But you don't get as much credit.
Right. To begin with, you should always try to do it, you know, the right way. But if you can, so you still get credit for saying Krishna. Okay.
But it goes with everything, not just Krishna.
Yeah, right, right. But of course, this is one of the prime examples. Okay? We learned, for example, about workmen, if you remember. If they're working on, you know, scaffolding, they're working on the top of trees and things like that. I mean, so what is the story about the recital of Krishna? How about Shemoneh Esrei and things like that? So we saw, as far as Krishna is concerned, if they can have kavana for at least Shema Yisrael, or at least through the first, you know, the first parsha of Krishna, so then they don't have to come down in order to recite it. For Shemoneh Esrei already we said that's a different story. But for Krishna, if you could have kavana at least this far, in that case, okay. And of course we also learn, you know, if you're going and you're taking, you have to go on a journey or something like that, so you stop for a moment, you know, in order to say Shema Yisrael, and then after that you can continue, because it's written after all, the Lech Lecha V'Derech, you see, you can continue. Okay. So these are some of the things that we learn. And then of course, the question about the Kavana of the Chosen, you know, whether he can fulfill the obligation of reciting Krishna, and under what circumstances therefore he would be free. Now, the third parak begins now with another case. And this is the case where, unfortunately, a person passes away. What is the din over there? So the Mishnah now begins by saying, Mi shemeisel mutalufono. When a person has someone who is one of his kroivim, you know, for whom he has to mourn, and he literally is lying before him, in other words, he has not yet been buried, he is what we call now an onein. An onein means, you know, that he is in the first stage of mourning, which consists of from the time of death before until burial. The time that the burial has taken place, and during this time the major concern of the onein should be to take care of the death of the dead person and see that he gets decent and honorable burial. Okay? So
he's absolved from all mitzvahs.
Right, so this is what we're going to read. It says Potem Kriya Shema, he is freed from the obligation of reciting Krishna, Umin Hatfilah, and also from reciting Shemoneh Esrei. Umin Hatfilah, also he's freed from the obligation of putting on tefillin. When they're called mitzvahs ha'amuras b'Torah, and from all mitzvahs that are written in the Torah. Now, of course, when we're saying they're called mitzvahs ha'amuras b'Torah, we are referring to what we would call the positive commandments, the affirmative commandments, in other words, things that a person says you should do. He's not potter from things that, you know, it says you should not do, because this is obvious. I mean, it doesn't have carte blanche, for example, to steal, to commit murder or anything like that. You know, these things are violations.
Or to eat
chadar,
no question,
right? Yeah, I mean, that you can't do. You say, or to, you should become a mechalal Shabbos.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we have to keep Shabbos even if we have lost someone near and dear to us. You see, you still have to keep Shabbos and not violate the Shabbos. Okay, so when it comes to the affirmative commandments, then in that case the onein is potter from them. Okay, so this is the first generalization that we have over here in the Mishnah. Now, not only of course is the onein potter because his major concern is to take care of the burial, but then there are other people who are also involved in the burial, the nosei hamito. These are the examples that they give over here. Okay, although in other passages they also quote some other categories. Okay, nosei hamita. In those days, I have to tell you that things were generally a little bit different than going to Harold Har Asher. Okay, may he rest in peace. After the tar was performed, they would of course wrap the body in the shrouds, Okay? And then they had, you know, like a stretcher or something like that. This is what they called the mita, a bier, whatever you want to call it, okay? Mita, of course, literally means bed, but in this case it's not a bed, it's a bier upon which they could carry it. Let's say it's sort of like a stretcher, okay? They would place the body on it, bring the body, of course, to the Beis HaKloros, to the cemetery, and there, of course, they would then proceed with the burial, okay? Now, since they didn't use hearses, they didn't use caddies either in those days, so what happened is, you know, that people would go on foot, and people would carry the bier, and then, because it could be quite heavy, they would pass the bier from one person to another. So this is what we're reading now in the next part of the Mishnah. It says, Nosei Hamita, those people who carry the bier, Tichilufeihen, and those who relieve them, Tichilufeihen, and those who relieve those who have relieved them. So, this is the din. Eshelifnei Hamita, those who are still in front of the bier, the Eshel Achar Hamita, and those who are behind the bier, there are two different dinim for them. Eshel of Neyamito, those who are in front of the bier, right? So Tzorech Pahem, they still are required to perform the obligation of doing what? Of carrying the mace upon their shoulders, you know, until they bring them to the Beis HaKloros. So in that case, therefore, Piturim, they are free of the obligation to recite Krishna, right? However, the Yeshel Achar HaMita, those who are behind the Mita, the idea, right? Those who are behind the Mita. Now here, there is first of all, Tzorach Bahem, Chayovim. If they still have to perform the task of carrying the bier, after all, you have to have people in front and people behind. So, if they perform the task of still carrying the bier, then in that case, whether they're in front of the bier or behind it, in any case, they are free from the obligation of reciting Krishna. Okay? I have to revise the last statement that I made. What the Mishnah is saying over here is that those who are behind the bier, right, and they're still needed, but nevertheless, chayovim, they are required to recite. Now, why are they required to recite? The answer is because they have already fulfilled the obligation, and therefore, they don't have to. To me, it doesn't quite make sense. I'll tell you why.
Yeah. Those were going to be the chalutim.
Those will be the chilutim, exactly. So in other words, they are still waiting for their turn to do it. So since they don't know at what moment they're going to have their turn to carry the bier, so therefore they are excused from saying Krishna. On the other hand, those who have already carried it and they fulfilled, you know, the obligation carrying the mess, and in that particular case, they do recite.
They don't mean they don't mean the people who are actually carrying it.
What I was saying. That's right.
They mean
this
the people that are already.
The Mishnah is a little bit vague at this particular point. It makes sense to me to understand it that if even though they're behind the mita, they're still carrying, then in that case they're still potter. There's no question about that. Question is only once they have been relieved of doing it, then you know they're walking behind, they're still going in the procession, but they no longer have to do it. So in that particular case, they recite the Krishna. This is what makes sense to me in the Mishnah. Okay.
If you're carrying it, you'd be carrying it forward. Say if you're carrying it, you want to relieve somebody who's in front of you to take it from.
Yeah, this is correct. But I'm thinking that literally, if a person is still holding on to it, then in that particular case, he does not have an obligation until he is relieved of the obligation to carry the mess. Once he's relieved of that, then in that particular case,
he has to concentrate on what he's doing.
Right.
He can't do it.
Concentration, of course.
Can't have kavana saying the Shema.
Absolutely. The mess takes precedence over anything else. Yeah.
It'll be able.
The elu, and it makes no difference whether they're before or behind. The Torah may not feel, as long as they are still engaged in the funeral procession, they are potter from reciting Shmoneh Esrei. Okay? Of course, it's a good question. I mean, why are they potter from Krishna, whereas they are, why about Krishna is there a question as to whether they are potter or not, depending upon whether they are actually engaged in carrying or whether they have already fulfilled. Whereas in the case of the Shmoneh Esrei, it says in either case, they have no obligation to recite the Shmoneh Esrei. But of course, I think that the basic reason is because Krishna is commanded to us in the Torah. So when you have, you know, a question of Kfura of the Mes, which is also, it's a command in the Torah. Because we find that in the case of a person, for example, who had to be executed by a Beis Din, so it's written, Kikavod tikberena bayomahu. You have to bury him on that very day. Okay? And from this we learn the general klal, that you don't delay the burial if you can possibly help it, because it's considered, you know, not to the honor of the mess to do so, but instead you try to do it as soon as you possibly can. Okay? So there's a mitzvah then from the Torah to do that, and therefore when you have one mitzvah of the Torah versus another mitzvah of the Torah, so the Chachomin say, okay, in that case you have to decide which gets the priority, right? Whereas Shmoneh Esrei, this is really from the Rabbanan, okay? Therefore the Rabbanan have the power to say that when it comes to a question of showing honor to the dead, which comes under the category of a mitzvah d'oraisa, as compared to davening Shmoneh Esrei, which is a mitzvah d'rabbanan, so that therefore they can legislate, you know, that you're potter from saying Krishna, whether you're still in front or whether you are behind the bier, as long as you're still occupied in burying the dead. Okay? Kavru Eshameis, now what happens after the Kavura, after the burial has taken place? The Chosru, and they get back. Obviously, they get back to where? They get back maybe to, you know, to the town, to their home, wherever they get back to. But as we'll see in a second, most likely, where did they come back to? They came back maybe to escort the Avelim into their home. This is how I understand it over here. If they can recite Krishna and finish it by the time that they reach the place where they have to form a double row for the mourners to pass through, then yaskidu, then they should begin to recite it. The imlav, but if they don't have time, in other words, one follows immediately upon the other, then lo yaskidu, then they should not begin to recite Krishna, because again, the respect shown to the survivors of this particular case, the mourners, takes precedence at this particular point. Now, how about the shura? So it says, ha'om dimash shura. Now, when people are standing in this double row, hapninim peturim achitunim chayovim. So, those who are within the row, in other words, they are actually there facing the Avelim, they are excused from reciting Krishna.
Krishna?
Yes, they are still excused from reciting Krishna. Okay? Whereas Hachitzonim, those who are behind them, in other words, not in immediate contact, you know, not immediately face to face with the Avelim, they are required to recite it. Because for them, the obligation is not as great as it is, you know, for the people who are right there and who, of course, will be saying words of consolation to the mourners.
Doesn't this assume that this is all taking place at the time that you're supposed to say the Shema? What if it takes place any afternoon?
That, of course, is not a question.
Then there's no
you're right.
No,
you're absolutely right. Right. It's a theoretical question, okay, but it's a practical question. As long as, let's say, it's being done the first thing in the morning,
right,
and you didn't have a chance, it's to say Krishna.
Right.
That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now the next thing is in brackets. The reason why is because in reality this belongs a couple of pages further on. Okay. It's the Mishnah over there. But we'll take a look at it anyway, because it gives a generalization. It says, Nashim Avodim Uktanim, women, slaves, and minors, peturim kriya shma min tefillin. They are, they have no obligation to recite Krishna or to put on tefillin. The chayovim bitfilo, but however, they do have an obligation to recite Shemin Esrei. Or the mezuzah, of course, they have to have a mezuzah in the house where they live in, or the door, or the room which they live in, Birkas HaMotzeh, and also they have an obligation to recite Birkas HaMotzeh. Now, these things we'll say for when we get to the proper place. Why and what is our own practice today as far as this is concerned. All right? Mm-hmm. Now, I just wanted to state that apparently, of course, I mean, we're dealing over here, I mean, while to this very day we still have what we call, we make a shura, in other words, we make a double row, we do it at the Beis Salem, okay? The mornings go through and then they go to the car and Patek and that's it. But now, once they've gone into the car, then in that particular case, they're on their way, they go home and so on and so forth. And since the dead has already been buried, therefore, from that moment on, they are required to perform all mitzvahs with one exception. That exception is something that we learned a few pages back, that tefillin on the first day are not to be put on. In other words, let's say the burial took place in the morning, okay? And the ovel, the mourner, came home again. He does not put on tefillin on that day. Why doesn't he put on tefillin that day? Because we learned there's a different din in that connection. And that is that tefillin, if you remember, we said are like pe'er. They are an ornament that we Jews wear, and so therefore the ovel does not put on the pe'er that first day as an expression of deep mourning, right? And this we learn from the Prophet Yechezkel, who was told precisely to do this because, as I explained to you at that time, his mourning was exceptional because it was mourning for the Jewish people, for the Churban Beis HaMikdash, which was even a greater tragedy than his own personal tragedy, as great as it was, so that it overrode his own personal avelis, the loss of his wife. So that, but for example, to daven, Shemin Esrei, I mean, you know, we tried to make minyonim in the home so that they could daven, you know, and say Krishna, Shemin Esrei, say a Kaddish and things like that. They're obviously required, you know, once they've come home, to wash before a meal, to recite Hamotzi, to recite Birkas HaMotzeh and things like that. Whereas before that, as long as the dead are still unburied, they are excused from these things. They do not recite Hamotzi, they do not bench with the Mezumen and things like that. We'll do that later when we start the Gemara next week, but I think we'll call it a night at this particular point. Okay, now next week I know that we'll meet. I just don't know the exact time that we'll meet because I did not receive the new bulletin as yet. And it depends what time the mincha has been scheduled. Later on, there's no question that if mincha, for example, is scheduled for 8 o'clock, obviously we'll get together over here and learn from 7 o'clock until 8 o'clock. And, that's it. But I don't know next week yet what time the rabbi has decided. Right now, we're still davening Bizman when we start davening at 7:30. But in another week, it could make a bit of a difference that it may be just a little bit too early. So I don't know yet what the time is. So we'll make announcements. I'll be in touch with you. And hopefully, we'll get our bulletins out by then, too. So we'll see. Okay. And on the base, the bottom of the page. Good evening. How are you, Ralph? Come and sit down and join us. Hearken to a word of Torah. All right. The Mishnah starts in at the beginning of the third chapter by saying, "Mi shemeisa muta lefono poto mekriya shma min hatfilin min hatfilin mekol mitzvahs amuris
b'Torah." Okay. Page 34 at the bottom. 34.
Well,
Page 34.
Ah, no, yeah.
34 at the top of the page.
On the top of the page, you see it says 34.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah.
And it's the back of Yud Zayin.
Yeah.
Second. How do you refer to it?
Huh?
Ahmed Olive and Ahmed Bey's. Ahmed Olive means first side, and Ahmed Bey's the second side. Yeah. Okay. So the Mishnah begins by saying, Misha Mesha Mutal Fadov. If a person has lost someone who is very close, a wife, a husband, a son, a daughter, a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, these are the seven close relatives for whom we have to sit shiva. Okay? So, one of these seven close relatives has passed away, and literally, mutal upon it means is placed there before him. In other words, is lying there before him. In other words, the burial has not yet taken place. Okay? So, what is the primary obligation of a person who you know, whose loved one has just passed away? The answer is to arrange for the burial. And therefore, because of the fact that they are concerned with making sure that the burial will take place, will be a proper burial and everything else that has to be done, so therefore they are excused from reciting Krishna, from the Shmona Esrei, from wearing tefillin, and from all mitzvahs that are stated in the Torah. Now, of course, I stated last week that here we are talking about what kind of mitzvahs. We're talking about affirmative mitzvahs, because negative mitzvahs, obviously, they are everybody is subject to them, regardless of whether they are in this particular state. Now, this state is the state that we call onein, which means a person who has just suffered the loss and the burial has not yet taken place. This is the first stage in avelus, in other words, the first stage in mourning. Then the next stage after that, after the burial takes place, then the next stage is, of course, that you become an ovel, first of all, for a period of 7 days, shiva, right? Shiva, remember, means seven. When people say to sit shiva, what they really mean is, you know, that you're staying home you're spending that time in mourning for 7 days, okay? And then the next period after that, which incidentally is also included, but it is the shloshim, the 30 days, and with the exception of the loss of a father or a mother, at this point, avel stops, so that the avel does not sit shiva for 7 days,
regardless.
Right. But the next 22 days, approximately, right, 22, 23 days, until the count of shloshim is over, so there are other forms of mourning that have to be observed. Not as stringent as shiva, when you don't do any work, you have to stay home and so on, but you know, you're permitted to go to work, you're permitted once more to resume family relations, you know, with your spouse and things like that, which are prohibited during the time of shiva. You can wear shoes again, you know, and do all these things, you see. But you have to observe mourning up to 30 days. When the 30 days have passed, so then at that point,
except
it ends, right. But in the case of a parent, then we observe avelus for 12 months. And of course, what form of avelus is observed after shloshim? The answer is that you abstain from all those things that have to do with simcha. In other words, going to parties, going to movies, shows, whatever it may
anything
be.
Anything that's
right.
Enjoyment.
Anything that's enjoyment, right. So, those are the various stages in...